Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started this afternoon with our session. Very excited to present this session to you, and I am going to turn things over shortly to Judy. The title of our session is Shifting Landscapes, Creating New Strategies for Persistent Challenges to Health Equity and Reproductive Justice for Women. And it's been my great pleasure to work with Judy and the rest of the panelists on organizing this thought-provoking session that's addressing a lot of very timely topics. And the Women's Caucus has really prided itself on presenting these types of sessions at the annual meeting, and I think that we will all be very exhilarated after hearing from these speakers. And so despite some things that are bleak and challenging, I do think that there's some direction for all of us to take away. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Judy. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I hope you're all active with the Women's Caucus. It's had its sort of roller coaster life over many years, but it brings a perspective to APHA that I think is very important. So we'll say this again later, but those of you who would like to come to a free reception where there will be wine and some hors d'oeuvres and no cost, you have to walk 7/10 of a mile or take the bus down Summer Street to South Station, and right there at One Financial Center on the 38th floor with some security at the first floor, there's going to be a reception where the APHA Section on Population, Reproductive, and Sexual Health awardees will be recognized, including Liz McGuire, Dan Grossman in his absence, and we have a speaker from Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center who runs, she's co-PI for the Infertility Family Research Registry there. So if you want to come, you're going to need to bring your badge and a picture ID to get in, and you're welcome. Sarah Weddington's going to be there too, so it's your chance to chat with her in person. We're going to do this as a kind of, one, two, three, four, and then we'll have a discussion at the end. So everybody keep track of your questions and things you want to ask every person. Our first speaker was going to be Ed Goldman, and he is at the University of Michigan, one of the four people who helped to organize the A3 and A2 conference back in May. It stands for Activists, Advocates, and Academics in Ann Arbor. And of course, during the course of the meeting, it became the A3 and A2 conference back in May. It stands for Activists, the role of art in promoting reproductive justice and social justice in general. And instead, because Ed had to teach and couldn't come, we're going to have a substitute presentation by Catherine Record, who is one of the newer board members at Our Bodies, Ourselves, and she also works at the Harvard Law School Center for Health Policy and Policy Innovation, and has been doing some amazing work over the last few years. So she's going to present on This Begins at Home, The Impact of American Political Discourse on Global Gender Equity. There are handouts with her slides at the back on that chair if you didn't pick one up. So Catherine, you're first.
Okay, well, thank you, and thank you for coming, and bear with me since I am a substitute, just jumping right in here, but hopefully I can live up to whatever you're expecting, and if not, I apologize. My work on this topic in the past few months has focused on comparing and contrasting what we're doing abroad in terms of promoting gender equity and the trends here within the U.S., of course not in every state, but in a growing majority of states in terms of backpedaling women's access to reproductive rights through a growing number of bills and, sadly, legislation that all of which have been challenged in the courts, but some of which have been knocked down and some of which not. So that is what I've been looking at. So really for the past 5 years, thanks to the Obama administration and former Secretary of State, Senator Secretary Clinton, the U.S. has pushed quite strongly for gender equity globally, investing in women's health, being adamant that investing in women's health is both the right thing to do and a smart thing to do, largely for economic reasons, but also the health outcomes that stem from that are significant. Clinton created several programs within the State Department's new Office of Global Women's Issues, And she appointed the first ambassador of global women's issues to run that office, which was then made a permanent position by President Obama, and Secretary Kerry is now ordered to reappoint a new person to fulfill that position. As Clinton stepped down, Secretary of State Kerry is expected to continue this legacy. Planned Parenthood applauded his nomination, describing him as a consistent supporter of women's rights and women's access to health care, both here in the United States and around the world. Yet at home, as many of you know, and by home I mean within the United States, we have seen many states backtracking, and you have a map, maybe on page 3 of your packet, if I recall, that just highlights by color which states are doing that based on some of the laws I'm going to mention. And so by restricting access to reproductive health care, U.S. legislators are making it increasingly difficult for women to access health care, and importantly, more difficult than it is for a man to access health care. So if you want to put that in more blunt terms, they're making it easier for a woman to have a child than not, regardless of its impact on her own health, which suggests that our efforts to achieve global gender equity may be contravened by our own laws. It's easy to condemn laws or practices that patently subordinate women and that we here in the U.S. find abhorrent, such as stoning women for perceived adultery, or condoning rape within a marriage or a relationship, banishing a woman suffering from a fistula, prohibiting women from driving, owning land, filing for a divorce, etc. But I query whether it's that different for a Saudi Arabian sheikh to allege that driving damages the ovaries and sacrifices fetal development than it is for a candidate for the U.S. Senate of America to claim that a woman can naturally and well naturally reject a fertilized egg that was done so in an act of rape. In short, no scientifically baseless restriction on women's access to comprehensive health care can be justified as anything other than to control her body and to perpetuate male dominance. And so I did a survey of legislative activity within the year of 2013 alone, and it's current as of October 2013, so we're a few days behind, and that's all in your packet, but and the end, the last page under the exclusion shows you that it's not, there are many more laws that I couldn't fit within a short presentation, but laws that are designed, certainly not phrased this way. The laws are always phrased to improve women's health and to protect women, but the practical outcome is either to reduce access to services without increasing patient safety, to disproportionately reduce access for low-income women, to reduce insurance coverage. We've seen that a lot as the ACA has, the Affordable Care Act has been rolled out, to disproportionately reduce access for minors, to implement scare or shame tactics to deter individuals from seeking abortion services, to discourage informed consent, which is one of the most shocking ones. 6 states have granted immunity from liability for physicians that do not inform their pregnant patients of a condition of the fetus that might affect that patient's choice to obtain an abortion. And then some very aggressive Roe v. Wade challenges that just patently violate what Roe v. Wade says is constitutional, and those laws are very clearly passed to start up a test case to try and overturn the law. So, and then there are many more, sadly, which you can look at the end of the list, and I'm happy to provide more detail on those, but I was asked to keep it brief, so thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, Jake Marcus is going to talk about some birthing justice issues, and Jake's CV is a mile long. Many of you may have followed her work as she supported the National Advocates for Pregnant Women and Lynn Telfeld's work, who's been doing so much legal work for so many years, and it's been greatly appreciated by all of us in the reproductive justice movement. And I'm going to let you read about her online and save her time for her to speak about what's really important.
comes from near Philadelphia.
Thank you. I actually come from Queens, but I've lived more than half my life near Philadelphia, but it's a New Yorker thing.
You never leave.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about government intervention in pregnancy and childbirth. Also, my little subtitle is Fetal Personhood and the Absence of Fetal Personhood Statutes. When speaking of government intervention in pregnancy and childbirth, my experience during 25 years of law practice in this area shows that one must clearly distinguish between law on the page, both legislation and case law, and public health policy in practice, what's happening, public policy on the street, health policy on the street. In the former realm, argument, mandate, sanction all occur in legislatures and courtrooms. Decisions concerning a hypothetical emergency in the life of any given woman are decided over the course of years. Details, statistics, procedures, briefs, studies, the time-consuming process of building a record, and lobbying for support, opposition, and change may have an impact only on individuals who are, and I speak here from experience, beings that are still yet possibilities, no more than sperm and egg, not even zygote. However, when dealing with public policy and childbearing in practice concerning a human today who is either pregnant, birthing, or has recently birthed, there's rarely time for a judicial decision concerning an idea as nebulous and contentious as fetal personhood, as well as the more concrete issues of women's rights and children's rights. I began my work in reproductive justice in 1981. I was punched by my first abortion clinic protester while volunteering as an escort in 1984. I know there are people in this room who aren't alive yet. I clerked on my first reproductive rights case in 1986, which was Northeast Women's Center versus McMonagall, the first use of the federal racketeering statute against abortion clinic protesters. I was in law school at the time, and I was junior associate on Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which is considered the last significant, I don't consider positive, since we really killed it at the district court level and then went to the Third Circuit, where some nobody named Alito had just been appointed and eviscerated what we'd done at the district court level. And then it went to the Supreme Court, and yes, it's in history, it's a good decision, but it's not what we accomplished, and it was not what we set out to accomplish. Anyway, I began working on that in 88, and that case went on into the 90s, as you probably know. I gave birth to my first child in 1994 at a hospital where I was coerced into an unnecessary cesarean section. So the benefits of the legal successes I was part of in 1986, and in Casey, ultimately in 1993, are still uncertain as to apply to the now 19-year-old child that I gave birth to in 1994. A little word of clarification. Despite in legal circles the negative connotation with referring to people who are pregnant as pregnant persons or pregnant people versus pregnant women that I have been fighting long and hard. No, they're pregnant women. Now I'm involved with a large community of trans men who are birthing. So a lot of my clients are actually male and are pregnant. So I'm now using this term I hated for so long, pregnant persons. And on that note, the child I gave birth to 19 years ago, who I thought was male, actually is now trans female. So this is the confusing life of pronouns in which I live. The news is now full of challenges to state statutes which seek to establish a thing called fetal personhood. While there's variation in the wording of each statute, the overarching idea in each of these is that a product of conception, which personally I think it would be a great rock band name, since the 80s I've been wanting to name a rock band the Products of Conception, never have. Well, I made t-shirts once though. Anyway, the product of conception is granted some or all of the civil rights granted by law to the person in whose body it resides. While certainly these statutes arise out of the movement opposing abortion, They also connect to an unresolved issue in the courts. When a pregnant person seeks to make a choice concerning a fetus or embryo, including a choice about a live birth, not someone who seeks abortion, someone who seeks to give birth, can a court intervene in this choice, and if so, under what circumstances? The most famous example of such a situation is that of Angela Carter and an incident that would become In Re AC. Angela Carter was diagnosed with cancer first as a young child. Her entire life was an often successful battle with cancer in different parts of her body. And in her middle 20s, after some years of remission and removal of her left leg and hip, she married and became pregnant. During her prenatal care, she unambiguously told her health care providers that if at any point during her pregnancy the pregnancy threatened her own health, that her own health would take precedence. However, at 25 weeks gestation, a cancerous tumor was found in her lung. Carter chose, after informed consent about the risks to her and to the fetus, she chose an aggressive form course of chemotherapy and radiation. Doctors had no plan to attempt to deliver the fetus. Her condition suddenly became worse, and at that point, hospital administrators, that department we know so well as risk management, made a move that was against the wishes of Carter's husband, parents, and the hospital's entire obstetrics department, which argued respecting the wishes of the patient was paramount and that the fetus was not yet viable. The hospital went to a court seeking a declaratory judgment as to whether a medical intervention was legally necessary, but their own counsel, hospital counsel, had told them it was not. The court appointed counsel for the fetus. The court ordered a cesarean section against all of these people's advice and against her will, which she was able to articulate clearly. The fetus died 2 hours after the surgery, and Angela Carter died 2 days later from complications of the surgery of the C-section. While the family sued, were represented by the ACLU successfully and won an overturning of the judge's ruling, of course, after everyone had died, both the AMA and ACOG issued statements opposing medical practitioners seeking court intervention in patient decision-making where the patient is able to clearly articulate a choice. Nonetheless, we're continuing to see healthcare practitioners and healthcare institutions seek court intervention to mandate medical procedures on pregnant persons. There have been a handful of other cases on court-ordered cesareans. Some of the decisions have followed the ultimate decision in In Re AC, which is the patient rules. Others have developed a balancing rights of the fetus against rights of the woman again, which is a backdoor way of saying there is fetal personhood if there are fetal rights. But what I am seeing at present is that healthcare providers and social service agencies intervene in the lives and choices of pregnant persons. And I have a client base, much of which comes through the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, and I strongly recommend visiting their site. And you'll see there a fairly comprehensive list of the ways the state intervenes in these decisions. One case going on right now, Alicia Beltran, who is a woman who is a recovering addict, admitted that at a 14-week visit, and under a Wisconsin law that empowers the state to involuntarily commit to a rehab facility anyone who is a quote-unquote serious, with no definition, drug user who refuses treatment. She was essentially incarcerated in a facility for 78 days despite the fact that a tox screen showed she was no longer a user. That case is going on now. But let me refer to several case studies of mine. Client A was 40 weeks pregnant with her fourth child. Her first birth had been a C-section. Her next two births had been vaginal deliveries, known as VBACs, vaginal birth after cesarean. VBACs are highly controversial for those of you who don't know, despite the fact that under the vast majority of circumstances, they pose no medical risk. Okay, so her third child had died before the age of one from unknown causes. And because of that, she had been reported to Children and Youth. There had been an investigation. Her children had been removed. That's another whole session that I do also, because I do also have clients who, if they engage in certain activities that, from a public health perspective, are frowned on with no evidence that they're dangerous, like Safeco sleeping, if there is what we would call a SIDS death, the children are removed pending an investigation, whereas if the child is in a crib, when the death occurs, there is no removal of children. Anyway, client A was therefore known to the system. So her OBGYN insisted that she schedule a C-section, and she didn't show up for it. And she called me. Nobody calls me when they're 10 weeks, by the way. They only call me when they're 40 weeks. So she did not have a time for a hearing on a preliminary injunction. There would be no briefs before the matter could be decided. She was already, quote unquote, post date, an expression that I do not use and don't believe in when referring to pregnant persons. I use it only when referring to my mother, who is post dates. So her only option was immediate action. Both her OBGYN and her OBGYN called Children and Youth. So Children and Youth and her OBGYN had made decisions based not on any law. There is no fetal personhood statute in Pennsylvania, which is where this took place and where I practice. However, they did appear at her house for a home visit and promised to return, leading her to believe that she was the subject of an active investigation. And she had two other children, that she might be forced to have a C-section, and that her children might be removed if she failed to, and the child, the fetus, when born, could be removed. These were all implied but never explicitly stated. That's, of course, when I get the call. And it was a referral from the National Advocate for Pregnant Women. Okay, so what client A then did is she made arrangements with home birth midwives to attend her birth. Let me stop there and go to client B. I know I'm running too long. Client B was 40 weeks pregnant with her second child. Her first had been a C-section. She wanted a VBAC. She'd shopped, found an OBGYN who agreed to allow her, quote-unquote, to have a trial of labor. All of this language, obviously, people making decisions, physicians making decisions that whether or not you will give birth in a certain way is his decision and not the decision of the person who is actually pregnant. Though he had agreed to allow a trial of labor, came to 38 weeks, and he said, oh, no, I'm not going to. We're scheduling a C-section. She didn't want to. She then called me. Now, again, I should neither woman had any physical risk factors, any medical complications, completely uncomplicated pregnancies, no reason that they couldn't give birth vaginally. Now, I followed then a protocol which I've developed. Get to the sort of meat of the how to move forward part of my discussion. I have a protocol when women come to me and they're facing state intervention. I don't start with the court. I start with the immediate situation. My protocol when I represent pregnant people facing intervention with their birth decisions is I first write a letter to the OBGYN involved. And in that letter, I state that I'm counsel for the woman, that she has chosen to discharge the OBGYN, that he is no longer her provider, that he is not to contact her any further, and that she will be seeking, she will be replacing him as a health care provider, but I provide no information whatsoever about with whom they will be replaced. And what this accomplishes is that I have terminated the relationship, so that the physician has no legal liability for what happens next. And the physician is also not facing abandonment issues under their own ethical rules. They haven't abandoned. They have been fired. And when I do this, I have never once had a physician respond to the letter, and I've never once had a physician attempt further contact with the woman. So it works, basically. But once they're in the system as the DH of the woman who had been reported, I do step two in my protocol, and it's what I call the Underground Railroad that I have invented for pregnant women. Now, as long as there's not an active warrant out for a woman, she's free to leave for a pregnant person. They can leave their home, they can go to another county, and remember that, you know, DAs and certain children and youth have no jurisdiction beyond their own county. So I keep them moving. I don't have them live at home. I have them go somewhere else. I know where that is. Sometimes I don't know where that is. But I'm not breaking the law, and they're not breaking the law. But they're unfindable until they give birth. In case A, the woman, they both went to 2 weeks post-date. The one who worked with the home birth midwife, ended up having a completely uneventful home birth, attended by a home birth midwife, not at her own home, at some other place, had a healthy child. That was that, for the time being. The other client, once she was approaching 10 days post-date, elected to have a scheduled C-section with the physicians who were backup for her midwife. So someone she was more comfortable with than someone who had said, do it now or else. With the client who was known to the system, before I advised her to return to her home, I contacted Children and Youth and had a very cordial discussion with a supervisor there, pointing out that Children and Youth has no jurisdiction over a fetus. You cannot endanger a child where there is no child. So, and he agreed and said that he regularly got these reports from OBGYNs, and they had no idea how to handle it, but they couldn't actually open an investigation. Unless there is a living child, there can't be a child endangerment investigation. So they frighten women, but the files actually don't exist. They're empty. Once I was sure that she was in the clear, then she went home. So in both these cases, physicians made decisions almost certainly based on a fear of liability and without checking on state law. All of those players sought to force an action by a pregnant woman despite there being no supporting law, and there will continue to be these cases involving hospital, physician, and state conduct, even without so-called fetal personhood statutes. Fetal personhood statutes, of course, make their basis in law, but we're seeing precisely the same comment where there are no fetal personhood statutes. So, from a public health policy perspective, emphasis must be placed on a patient's right to make treatment decisions, even bad treatment decisions, those considered bad by the OBGYN, and sometimes decisions that are just plain bad. It isn't our decision or the provider's decision. If providers are discharged, they're not at risk for any kind of legal liability in the event something bad happens, and they have not abandoned the patient because the patient has chosen. So that's the overarching theme, that in the absence of fetal personhood, where there is an application of a fetal personhood idea by state actors, that court intervention is not the first move. The first move is to make it clear that there's no liability possibility, and then keep the woman in a place where she'll be able to make her own decision, even if it's one we don't agree with. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a lot of food for thought there. So our next speaker is Malika Redman, and she's the executive director of Spark for Reproductive Justice. She's also a current board member of our Bodies Ourselves, as is Catherine, and we really are lucky to have them on board. And I am the current executive director, which I'm not sure I got introduced in the beginning, but anyway, I'm with Our Bodies Ourselves as well. And Malika's going to talk a little bit more about what her work is as well as Spark, as well as the issue.
Okay. thanks for the introduction, Judy, and thank you all for coming this afternoon. And what I'm going to do is talk about reproductive justice. And it may or may not be a term that you're familiar with, but I'm going to give an opportunity I'm going to take the time of the day to define reproductive justice, do a little bit of the history of the framework and the movement, then talk some about what are some of the interesting tensions around reproductive justice, and then look at what is current in terms of the work with my organization, Spark Reproductive Justice Now, but also the ways in which the framework of reproductive justice is being used largely within a reproductive health, rights, and justice movement. Okay. So just to start, reproductive justice really began, can be defined as a framework that allows for those things that impact women's lives to be included, economic justice, environmental justice issues, looking at the layers of social determinants with and how systems of oppression impact a woman's life. The definition was one that was championed by African American women leaders of the reproductive health and choice movement, really solidified in the mid-1990s and has become a part of the larger movement for reproductive health and rights ever since. It's something that really began to be a conversation, a tension after Roe v. Wade, a few years after when the Hyde Amendment was put in place. And those who were interested in talking about the issue of choice, but in a larger way, those knowing that because of Hyde, women who were dependent on Medicaid coverage, those who depended on assistance from the federal government for their health care, were no longer allowed to be able to access abortion in particular because it was banned based on Hyde. And that what then became no longer a choice issue, but one that those women who were low income were now vulnerable and susceptible to not being able to actualize that choice for abortion care, in particular because of the Hyde Amendment. We know that today over 33 states have replicated and implemented Hyde-like amendments, and so therefore not only do we have a federal ban, but largely state bans on abortion access for women who are low income. That particular tension, that particular issue in some ways inspired women who were interested in economic justice issues, who were part of and working on civil rights issues, working on a number of other issues, to say that in order for us to effectively advocate on behalf of all women living in this country, that there's no way to do that without addressing those barriers that impact women's lives beyond just a privacy issue around choice. That if women can't actualize that choice based on their economic status, their geographical location, you know, whether they are in rural areas or areas around the country where access to full and comprehensive reproductive health care is just not available, then we're not doing a lot of women a service by only talking about this issue in a singular privacy conversation or privacy sort of paradigm. And so it became that in which particularly women of color who championed reproductive health access, family planning access, sexual health access, to say we need to broaden our idea of how we go and fight for these issues. And in order for us to have a movement that is robust and vibrant, we need to include the voices and the leadership of those women also at the table that have been largely marginalized from those policy conversations, those advocacy opportunities in those activist moments. And so hence we have reproductive justice, excuse me. And reproductive justice really took steam and really pushed forward an opportunity to welcome younger women, women of color, Native American women, women who identify as LGBT, and we see this becoming broader and broader. Because what reproductive justice has allowed for are more people to be able to see their issues within a larger justice framework. How does that work? Well, when we look at what are some of the interesting tensions, some of the ways in which reproductive justice sort of is different, but also central and a part of what we know as reproductive health movement, or reproductive rights and reproductive choice. When we think about reproductive rights, we think of, largely about sort of the human rights framework, think about a legal framework. We're talking about ways in which we get access for women, proactive ways of getting access through a legal and through a human rights idea. When we think about health, we're thinking, of course, about, you know, disparities. We're thinking about the ways in which women have access to either providers. We're thinking about the ways in which the medical institutions understand and have empathy and an approach to support women's health in a way that is broad and is respectful. When we think about choice, we're thinking about the political fight around access to abortion. And we're thinking about the ways in which making a case for it being a right for each woman to be able to make with the privacy for herself and make that determination without state intervention. When we think about justice, we think about the ways in which for women, how other issues shape the ways in which women can and are able to make decisions around their health, make decisions for their families, make decisions about their lives. And so with the justice framework, we consider things as, just like what Jake was saying, we think about, you know, women who are maybe experiencing criminalization, women who, because they are transgender, maybe not getting the kind of support from their medical providers in a way that can help them navigate their family planning options. We think about young women being able to have access, whether it's on their college campuses, whether it's in their communities, whether it's because of laws that have parental notification, having access to being able to say and determine for their own health and their own bodies, their own future. We think about the disproportionate impact for women of color, particularly women of color in low-income communities. What does it mean to be able to have, you know, access to high-quality health care that is culturally competent and sensitive, that allows for women to be able to have the choices with whatever kind of family planning contraceptive that they want to use and choose for their family. Reproductive justice allows for us to also talk about the ways in which abortion is one pivotal issue for around reproductive health, but it's not the only. That for certain communities of women, choice is one issue, but not perhaps not one in which they've been disproportionately impacted. So through a reproductive justice framework, we can also talk about forced sterilization and understanding how the history of forced sterilization in this country, one that has been central to the history and the lives for many women of color in the United States of America, and something that we have to continuously be vigilant about how sterilization plays itself out in different communities. Reproductive justice as a framework wants to talk about that and does talk about that. And so when we get to those organizations that have adopted a reproductive justice framework and themselves looking more broadly about how we do the work of supporting reproductive health policy, how we do the work of organizing women, organizing our communities, what we have decided to do is say that we need to be able to engage women where they are. We need to understand and know that in order to talk about family planning, we also have to ask women in their communities, what are the pressing issues? how is it that you are able to get the sort of services that you need? And if you cannot, what are some of those reasons why not? How can we begin to encourage and bring more women into the fold to be able to advocate on their own behalf? And so at Spark Reproductive Justice Now, we are a 7-year-old organization. We came out of the Georgians for Choice, which was a coalition organization based in Atlanta, Georgia. We are based in Atlanta, Georgia. That brings together women who, you know, at the base and at the bottom line are looking to support reproductive freedom in the state of Georgia. We put at the center of our core constituency our young people, young families, LGBTQ youth, and women of color. And we organize our communities around the kind of policy issues, the women's health policy issues that they say are most pressing. And then we begin to build our campaigns around that. One of the two things that I'd like to talk about in terms of those campaigns, one is that we actually had 3 years ago, we worked on a birth justice issue. One of our volunteers had actually been shackled during her pregnancy, during labor and delivery as an incarcerated woman. And it was something that we had some idea about, but is largely not known. I think the work of Advocates for Pregnant Women and other organizations have really brought this issue to the forefront for many of us who don't know this goes on. But in the state of Georgia, the Georgia Corrections does have a practice of keeping women shackled who are incarcerated through labor and delivery. And that shackle isn't just a hand shackle. We're talking about a 5-piece shackle. So that's the chain that goes here to here, down to the feet, and connecting the feet. And this 5-piece shackle stays on a woman through, again, labor and delivery. Now, mind you, when a woman is being moved from the prison to the hospital, there are armed guards, of course. Armed guards remain at the door, in front of her admitted door. And so there's always someone who is armed, who is a guard that is there. However, the shackles remain on the woman as she's having a baby. This was something that we thought it was very important for our communities to understand better, and we put forth a proactive piece of birth justice legislation called the Birth with Dignity Bill. Our initial thought was that this would be something that would be a cross-the-aisle kind of issue. We know that Georgia is staunchly red and staunchly right-wing, so in thinking that this would be a proactive piece of birth justice legislation that our allies, of course, would be on board, but also some of the those who call themselves pro-life would also see that this kind of birth justice legislation could be something that they could back and support, and at the very least would not try to fight against. At the very least, if they weren't going to actively be on board to support that, at the very least, they would not actively fight something that was a birth justice piece of legislation. Oh, were we wrong? Oh, did we not know that, in fact, it was going to be a fight and still remains a fight? And that we got 4 really strong, brave women in the Georgia Assembly to sign on to the bill and push it as far as they could. It got it to a hearing. We had some very amazing women who we had, again, with the reproductive justice framework, of course, is about encouraging the women that we work with to be able to articulate what it is they need. We worked with our activists for a year, getting them prepared to be able to testify, to be able to talk about what their experience. We had a broad coalition, including faith leaders, because that's important in Georgia, and practitioners, doctors and nurses who talked about the compromise when a woman is chained to be able to support a healthy delivery. And yet we had major pushback. You had those who were who claim to be pro-life legislators say, you know, well, we're not talking about normal women. They're incarcerated for a reason. Wanting to ask the women, why were you incarcerated in the first place? And use what we know is an old tactic of blaming women as a way to push back on not pushing for what is just so obvious and had enough broad base of support. But in Georgia, the Georgia Right to Life is a significant force. They have lots of money, and they support a number of our policymakers there. And so this is a fight that we continue, and we have been able to, what's been very core for us and actually something exciting for us in terms of this victory is that we were able to get a lot of sort of public outcry on this. And so actually State Corrections actually made a public statement with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution saying that they've learned a lot from these efforts and are going to change their policy. So our work this year, this statement came out last year, our work this year, of course, is to follow up with corrections to monitor and to see, you know, how often this is really being incorporated into their practices and continue to talk about this issue. And then lastly, SPARC, along with our other coalition partners in the state, are working on, of course, actualizing the full promise of the Affordable Care Act. We know that Georgia is a state that has defaulted to the federal exchange, but also is one where our governor and even our insurance commissioner is saying that they will do everything in their power to obstruct anything to for Georgia around ACA. And that includes the Medicaid expansion. And so a number of our coalition partners, including the National Domestic Workers Alliance and a number of other very important groups that embrace a reproductive justice framework and idea, are coming together and bringing our members together to really fight around this issue. We know that in Georgia alone, we have close to 10% of the population is uninsured in Georgia. We have over 600,000 people in Georgia who would be eligible for Medicaid with the expansion. We know that, you know, just by expanding Medicaid alone would bring tens of thousands of jobs to a state that needs jobs. And we know it's just the right thing to do. Ultimately, it's something that Georgia needs. And so, this is our current fight. This is what we continue to work on. And we use reproductive justice as a way to, again, bring broader coalitions together. It's a way that we can bring our faith community into a conversation that fights for women's health. It's a way that we bring into the fold organizations like Jobs for Justice, Domestic Workers Alliance, young people into the fold to understand and start where they are and begin to fight overall for what we know are health justice issues and ultimately women's health issues and access to reproductive justice. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Malika. And I just want to say for those of you who came in late, we have a one-page list of websites that give you much more information about some of the topics that we're addressing. And I also want to say that when we open this up for discussion, I'd like you all to think about, from your own experience and what you've read, where you see some of these shifting landscapes. And I'll just throw out a couple of examples. So back, a few decades ago, they were trying to send, women into a hospital for a forced cesarean section. It pretty frequently was the case. And then not only your work, but also another lawyer, also from New York, Janet Gallagher, finally pulled together all the facts around the reality that many of these physicians were wrong, that nothing bad would happen to the mother and the baby if she didn't have the cesarean. And she wrote a very important article that was in the journal read by the judges. And after that article was read by many judges, that rate at which judges okayed these forced cesarean sections went way down. So that kind of attack on birthing rights isn't the case now, but instead what we see are things like lack of access to VBAC, because in many, if not most, communities in this country, for liability reasons or whatever, women are not given the option of having a trial of labor once they've had a cesarean. So that, in a sense, denies them a legitimate option, but through another route. So the landscape shifted, but the denial of access to a legitimate birthing choice occurs. We see some very similar things with home birth as well. Also for sterilization abuse. Now, how many of you remember the sterilization abuse guidelines, 1979, then Dr. Julius Richmond, who was head of what was then HEW, Health Education and Welfare, he really responded to growing chorus of protesters from communities of color, from the women's health movement, saying we have got to stop this degree of sterilization abuse, where women are sterilized without informed consent, told something in a language they don't understand. There's a whole array of ways in which women were sterilized without what we'd call informed consent. It led to those federal sterilization abuse guidelines. Well, we are actually in a very different place right now, where there are physicians who actually supported those guidelines back then, suggesting that the guidelines may be an encumbrance on access to sterilizations that even low-income women of color might want today. And we can talk about that later as well. I'm going to, in the interest of time, just race through these, because these slides are online, so you can go and look at them later, and you can link to the websites and spend more time thinking about some of these issues. But I just wanted you to know what we've got here. Some of you don't know the history of our bodies ourselves. That's the story of the Women and Their Bodies, which actually came out in December of 1970. It was renamed Our Bodies Ourselves a few months later when the New England Free Press reprinted. But this is, in some ways, our start on a long journey of working for originally reproductive rights, and now we think of it much more broadly in human rights terms, reproductive justice. This is 9 editions later, and if you haven't seen this book, well, actually, we don't even have a copy at the National Women's Health Network booth, but we might have one there tomorrow. I think it might be our best edition yet. And it was named by the Library of Congress as one of 88 books that shaped America in a big exhibition last year. There are just many, many, several dozen foreign language adaptations. There's just one example. And the groups of women who work with us, and they produce these booklets or books themselves, do a tremendous amount of reproductive justice work. Sometimes it involves training women to provide, in this case, manual vacuum aspiration abortions. Abortions are still very hard to get. Even sometimes when they're legal, they're hard to get safe abortions. This is a group in Nigeria that particularly worked on HIV/AIDS. There was a collaboration of Palestinian Jewish Israeli women in East Jerusalem working on an Arabic edition, which is now available online, and a Hebrew edition. These are our colleagues in Istanbul and Turkey, and you can imagine their disarray at the moment, because Erdogan, who's a fundamentalist, religious fundamentalist, basically, hiding behind a lot of secular language, but his true colors are now out, and he has basically made abortion inaccessible in Turkey. It's not illegal yet, and women are in the streets fighting, and this group is among them. But that is just a statement on how, wow, the shifting landscape. Turkey was one of the very first countries to make abortion legal. There was a pact between the church clergy and the government. If you do this quietly, we won't protest. But it is now, even though it's not completely illegal, most physicians, many of whom are fundamentalists, will not actually provide abortions. So I want to refer you to these wonderful definitions of reproductive justice. And you alluded to it, Malika, but the language is just extraordinary. It really underscores why it's important to not just think narrowly in terms of individual reproductive rights, but more broadly in terms of community, access to resources, social justice. I won't take the time to read these now, but please go and look them up. There's also this fabulous reproductive justice briefing book. How many of you know about it? It's got wonderful contributions, 1-2 pages by people like Lynn Paltrow, on all the topics that are related to reproductive justice. And it's quite lengthy. It's only available online. You won't have a hard copy of that. There also are going to be more materials related to A3 and A2. And there is a wonderful article, which you can link to from our website, by the four academics at University of Michigan, including Timothy Johnson, who heads up their OBGYN department in the hospital OBGYN department, Lisa Harris, who's well known in the reproductive justice field, another OBGYN, Ed Goldman, who couldn't be here, and Alexandra Stern, who's done a lot of work on sterilization abuse. And the four of them have written something at feministing.com that is an interesting discussion of their perspectives. This is the link to that article. And it was not an easy meeting, I have to say. There were some tensions, and it's what always happens when those with lots of access to resources, and that includes most academics, not all, meet up with community folks who have to struggle with practically no resources. There's always tension for all the reasons you can imagine. So this is a very important documentary, which you have not brought to, if you haven't brought it to your campus or your community yet, do think about it, because this is one of the very first explorations of what really happened in Los Angeles County Hospital back in the 60s and 70s, where lots of Chicana women were sterilized without informed consent. And they went back and they interviewed the doctors. They had some original footage, and they have some more recent footage. And they've interviewed the women who had these sterilizations. So it's an extraordinary then and now. And I urge you to think about getting it into your community. We showed it in Ann Arbor. I also want to say that this is an extraordinary example of trying to achieve social justice in the sexuality arena, particularly regarding the missteps of the pharmaceutical industry, sometimes trampling all over what we would call evidence-based medicine. So learn more about the New View campaign. There's also a huge amount to be said for following best practices. We know a lot about what constitutes good maternity care. In many of our hospitals, they're not following what we would call best practices, and so we all need to work on that as a social justice issue. These are just, this is an example that we really have to provide equal primary care payments to midwives under Medicaid. Under the ACA, some of you may know now that the facility fee for freestanding birth centers will be covered. It wasn't covered before, so there wasn't a level playing field. It was hard for freestanding birth centers to make ends meet. And ACOG opposed that. Not many people know that, but they opposed the coverage of the facility fee. And I think that says something about some of their true allegiance, because the evidence is so strong. We had the second national birth center study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier this year, findings just as good as 20 years ago. And in fact, many people thought the outcomes would be worse because women are heavier, women don't have they don't have as much good health, and you can, maybe that's true, but the outcomes for birth centers are just as good. This is a statement some of you may want to go and sign on. We have mostly people in the field who provide care, who are in the public health field, supporting these very three important elements of making sure that we have safe options for choices in childbirth, preserving and expanding DBACs, expanding hospital-based midwifery care, utilizing CNMs and certified midwives in some states. And then this is a very contentious issue, which is to license and regulate CPMs to make home birth as safe as possible. And you know, there are OBGYNs who are not pretty, they're not happy with the idea of home birth, but they're very amenable to this idea that at least this kind of floor for the kind of training that the providers of home birth services offer would be a good thing. I'm not going to get into this, but this is a rather important lawsuit about patenting human genes, and there were two women's health public interest groups, Breast Cancer Action San Francisco and Our Bodies Ourselves, who served as co-plaintiffs, and this, of course, challenged the BRCA 1 and 2 patents of Myriad Genetics. I'm going to skip the stuff about female condom, but there are many, many groups around the world who are trying to assert access to a very important means of protection against both pregnancy but also STIs. And in many places, the female condom is simply not made available. Instead, long-acting methods like implants and long-acting injectables are privileged over access to these methods. And that should not be the case. Women should be getting choices, especially a choice that can protect them from disease. There are some fabulously funny and entertaining videos that were produced for Global Female Condom Day. Go look them up. You'll have fun watching them. This is the site for those videos. There's also a fair amount we've been doing around assisted reproductive technology, particularly the increasing demand for women's eggs, both for IVF purposes and for use in research, somatic cell nuclear transfer research. And there's also an increasing demand for women as commercial gestational mothers. The capital, so-called surrogacy capital, is no longer in the United States, it's in India. And we believe that there will be other countries like Mexico and Nepal following suit as well. I will say that we had a victory this past summer when we urged Governor Jerry Brown to veto a very controversial bill, AB 926, which would have expanded the commercial market in eggs by allowing payment for eggs for research. And although both the Assembly and the Senate passed it, he vetoed the bill. And that's a wonderful story we can tell you another time. And these are some of the reasons that we're working on these issues. There is also a very important lawsuit, Klein versus Abbott, that is dealing with the Lupron issue. And one of the most famous doctors treating endometriosis cases for the last 30 years became an expert witness for this lawsuit. And it's going to be heard by the Supreme Court because of some complaints about how a district court handled it. These are just some of the ads for egg donors. They go up to $80,000 to $100,000, although most young women are paid between $5,000 and $10,000. The speaker tonight at this reception is going to be Dr. Judy Stern from Dartmouth-Hitchcock. She's the co-PI for the Infertility Family Research Registry. It's currently the only place in the country that will systematically track the health of young women, except young women who are egg donors don't know about the existence of this registry. Even though ASRM is funding, in part, this registry, they do practically nothing to promote awareness among young women who really need to be signing up to have their health tracked. This is just a screenshot. This is an excellent 40-minute film that tells the story of surrogacy through the eyes of women who are gestational mothers. It was produced by Sama Resource Group for Women and Health in New Delhi. We have copies if you ever want to show it on your campus. There's another award-winning film. It's a feature-length film called Made in India that is also very delicately deals with this issue very sensitively as well. We've got a lot of challenges. I'm going to skip over these. Again, it's not just the drug industry, it's the device industry, and after all these years, we still haven't collected adequate safety data, especially for silicone gel breast implants, so that young women seeking breast implants solely for cosmetic purposes, this is not even for reconstruction after mastectomy, are going into this thinking that these things are totally safe, and we don't have that evidence. Teen Voices is no longer available, but there's a new collaboration of Women's eNews in New York City and Write Boston, which is doing the writing and the mentoring of teens in Boston. And online, you'll start to see articles written by teens for teens, just like the glossy magazines. You can get copies of the glossy magazines tomorrow at the National Women's Health Network booth. We'll have some copies there. We had a fun Our Bodies, Our Votes campaign when we learned not that long ago that the cohort least likely to vote in the last major election was young unmarried women. My own niece came up to me after she turned 18 and told me she wasn't going to register to vote. And I looked at her and I thought, my late brother, his ashes are flying in the sky somewhere. I was just so shocked. And when we sat down, we talked about what was at stake. She knew nothing about attacks on contraception. But she not only voted, she got all her friends to register and vote, because these were all young women who cared about these issues, but they were clueless. They weren't watching the news. They weren't reading the papers. And that was a wake-up call for me, too, about how much more we have to reach out. National Women's Law Center, American Association of University Women, all of us tried to reach young women and activate them to vote, however their conscience led them. And so we highlighted these issues, which you've heard about earlier, and people put their stickers. In fact, we'll have bumper stickers here tomorrow if you want them. This is from Austin, a group of community women. Students put it on there. And this is a little one for computers. And then after that, we decided to educate Congress with giving copies of Our Bodies, Ourselves, along with Christy Turlington Burns, to every member of Congress. Gary Peters from Michigan, there's Jean Shaheen from New Hampshire, Minnesota. That is Adam Kinzinger, who is a Tea Party Republican who didn't know what he was doing that day. And he said, thank you for the book. And those are two National Women's Health Network interns with me. And we left thinking, is this man ever going to open that book? We wondered. But anyway, and there's, of course, one of my senators, Elizabeth Warren, who's Diana Zuckerman from the National Research Center for Women and Families. Another important tool in our kit to promote reproductive justice is this fabulous magazine that's not that well known, but the Men's Health Caucus, which has a series of wonderful events, will have copies of this tomorrow at their booth. And there are some great links to exciting things, Men Engage, UN, some projects that White Ribbon Day in Massachusetts, which is, I think, a model for the rest of the country. And this is, in my mind, one of the best and funniest things ever done to promote evidence-based healthcare using history, using humor. And they use the actual music is Coldplay's Viva La Vida. And so you'll love it. You'll love the lyrics. So with that, I'm going to stop, and it's your turn to make comments, ask questions of the panelists, and think about ways in which you are having a sort of then and now experience or have questions about, you know, something from the past that we're maybe neglecting at this point. So your turn. Order. Thank you.